This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, good people, and welcome to another episode of Moments That Rock. I'm your host, Tony Michaelidis. Moments That Rock is part of the Pantheon group of podcasts. Now, let me tell you a little bit of information about the whole platform, so to speak. It's full of music-orientated podcasts, people interviewing artists, industry insiders, all sorts of things. Really good shows. Mine's one of them. If you want to delve back, if you're new to the show, then you want to delve back. There'll be old interviews from the Ramones, Joey and Dee Dee, who sadly have passed away. Steve Winwood, Sir Ray Davis, Morrissey, there's Peter Hook from New Order, well, from New Order in the early days, in Joy Division. And we have a series of about four or five programmes about U2. We have Malcolm Gerry talking about Red Rocks. We have Bono and the Edge interview. We have the Edge and Adam Clayton, Dave Robinson, who ran the label around the Unforgettable Fire. Well worth checking out. We also delve into stories from music industry insiders. They're very helpful for budding musicians, for people who are just interested in rock stories. And also, they share moments that rock their world. If you're a regular listener, and if you're not, and if you are not, then please come back for more, subscribe, and we'll give you plenty more, because there's lots of people lined up over the coming weeks. The music industry inside a bit is really interesting to me because it's a lot of old colleagues that I've had over the years that I'm learning things that I didn't know about, which is really, really revealing. And like I said, great advice. What we also do is we restrict them. We put them out weekly and we restrict them to about 20 to 30 minutes maximum. And anything that's left on the cutting room floor, we dig them out and we put them out over the following weeks. So we keep the episodes fairly short and listenable so you can come back for more. This is something of me delving into the archives of stuff that we had left. So you're going to hear, first of all, Bill DeYoung, who's a journalist, who's interviewed a lot of amazing people. And, well, he can tell you the rest about himself. There's a previous dialogue with Bill DeYoung in previous Moments That Rock podcasts. And we also have Denise Baton, who was with me at Arista Records back in the day. And she's been on the show before, and she'll be finishing off with her last little bit of recounts of things that she loved. Oh, that's a lot of blabber from me. So we'll get on and start with Mr. Bill DeYoung.
So I became a journalist through no fault of my own. And, what I did was I ended up going up to Gainesville, where Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers are from, and going to the University of Florida. And when I got a job at the newspaper there in Gainesville, it occurred to me that Gainesville, Florida had two exports that were very kind of significant, important in the world. One, of course, was the Florida Gators football team. Now, I didn't give a rat's ass about sports. I still don't. And the other one was Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And nobody at the newspaper was writing anything about this band, which had come out and done great things from their town. So I took it upon myself to be the Heartbreakers guy. Started making calls. And, before long, I, connected with management, and they put me together with the band. And for, 20 years or however long it was, I basically wrote about them constantly and would visit them on the road. And I was the hometown newspaper guy.
I thought there was some interesting stuff here. And being a fan myself, I'm the kind of person who likes to sort of read everything you can find about an artist and their process and how they came to whatever conclusions to create whatever they created. So I sort of thought, I have this stuff. that if I was a fan, I might want to read. You know, as I say, there's two interviews with Neil Young in there, four with Petty. And I thought, if I don't do this, because after the Goldmine stuff had been printed once, the copyright reverts to me. If I don't do this, these things are just literally going to be lost. That was the whole idea. And again, sort of with the George Martin, and I interviewed Mary Hopkin from Apple Records, who doesn't do interviews. And it was a great interview. And I thought, somebody somewhere is going to give a damn about this, you know. Yeah, probably especially the Petty stuff and that. And so that's why I did that. So it was a fun, if I can say that, project to go in and re-listen to all these tapes and kind of retranscribe everything and fix a few clams that I hadn't caught the first time. You know, oh, that's not what he said this, you know, and sort of put it together and out there. And there, you know, this lengthy interviews with Linda Ronstadt, with Emmylou Harris. I spent a lot of time with Guy Clark and his wife, Susanna, great songwriters from Texas, both of whom are gone now. And when I started the project, I didn't realize I had that recording. It was just in a box, like I said. The one I did with Dave Mason, where he proved to the world that he's kind of a jerk. He got really angry when that story came out, by the way.
Oh,
so
did
it was
he?
Great. Yes, because he hated it. And I was grateful.
Well, tell us the story.
I ended up speaking to Tommy LaPuma, who's gone now. He was his producer at Blue Thumb Records, and to several guys who played in his band for years and years. And every one of them told me that, I don't know if I can say the word, you can bleep it, what an arsehole the guy is. I mean, it was like story after story. And, you know, I just printed what they said. And I talked to him, and he was, I found him rather aloof. And I've seen him since. He doesn't remember who I am, thank God. And, you know, he's a nice enough guy, but his story, one of the reasons I think, and I suppose I can go out in public and say this, one of the reasons I think that he never really sort of made it a like big career guy is because he burns bridges. If you do something he doesn't like, he will come out and publicly, belittle you. And he's been sued so many times. And Dave Mason, to my knowledge, is the only person to get fired from the Ringo Starr all-star band. And I mean, how low do you have to go for that to happen? You know, you know, love you, Dave. Alone Together is great. I love It's Like You Never Left. Love the early records. But that was sort of what you were saying before about how I don't know that I really want to meet my heroes. There was an example of like, I didn't, you know, but I was glad to put that story in the book, just if anybody wants to know how that transpired, here it is.
I'll just interject for a minute. Bill DeYoung lives in Florida. He's from Gainesville, and he met and worked, didn't work, but actually wrote a lot about Tom Petty back in the day, plus a lot of stuff. And he's talking about his lost interviews. And now he's going to tell us a little bit about meeting Willie Nelson and talking to him.
Yeah, both occasions when I was fortunate enough to speak to him, he was plugging something. Right. So the first one was Farm Aid, first Farm Aid in 85. God knows how, but I, after a gig in Gainesville, I got on his bus and the two of us just sat there for 90 minutes just talking. And he was mostly talking about Farm Aid, you know, because it was the first one. And here's what Willie Nelson says and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm listening and I'm nodding along and, you know, and then I remember listening to this tape when I was transcribing it. I'm sitting on his bus. It's me and him and his dog, Elvis, the tick hound. I remember it well. After that ran its course, I said, can we talk about music a little bit? And he said, yeah. He said, you know, I wasn't going to do any interviews on this tour. He said, I just wanted to talk about Farm Aid, but go ahead. And then we talked for another half an hour or so just about what he was doing. I mean, at that point, it was the Geffen year, so it was sort of he was kind of reaching out in all different directions. What am I doing? He hadn't sort of come back to what he does best yet. But he kind of explained about kept looking for something and hadn't found it yet. And I thought it was very, very interesting. And so the next time was, I don't know, 97, 98 on the Horde tour And again, I have no idea why he did. That was a phone interview. I got Elliot on the phone. Elliot hands him the phone. He's sitting on the bus. Hey, Bill. And, you know, he had just done. Oh, I know what it was. He had just not shown up at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction for Buffalo Springfield. It had just happened. So we talked about that. And he's very frank and he's very, very funny. You know, a very dry sense of humor. And sort of like Petty was a very funny guy, too. And I think, you know, Ian Anderson, you know, for all his foibles and quirks, is a very funny guy. And I find that that's something that a lot of these people have. I think Bowie was had a great sense of humor.
Oh, incredible.
What's the common denominator there? You know, that they, you know, they know when to take themselves seriously, but they also know when not to.
Couldn't agree more. Some excellent outtakes talking about Neil Young, Willie Nelson, etc., etc. And there's other stuff from Bill if you scroll back and find out an early edition of Moments That Rock. We'll be back in a moment. I just want to go back quickly to Neil Young. You said he like had a great sense of humour and stuff. Were you finding yourself kind of asking him fan questions about things that, you know, you really wanted to know yourself, or?
Well, I don't think the things I really wanted to know myself were fan questions.
Right.
You know, it mostly would be like, you know, let's talk about Comes a Time and the fact that you bought the first 40,000 copies off the press because you were going to change the song sequencing. They had printed 40,000. You bought them all and shingled your barn roof with them. Let's talk about, this is a true story. You know, let's talk about that. We talked a lot in the archives that he's putting out now are amazing, but in those days we would talk about the unreleased songs. Where was this record going? You know, I love talking about the records and the process, you know, because, and I think that artists respond to that much more than what did you have for breakfast or were the 60s swinging, you know, because that's the connection.
Yeah.
No, not even so much the music and the songs, but how did you make this record? Petty loved to talk about making records. And so that would be the kind of questions I asked. And, you know, not the least of which that a lot of these I was writing for Goldmine, which was very heavily a record collector's magazine in those days. You'd ask, like, well, you know, you put this song on the B-side of the single, but it wasn't on the album. Why was that? You know, that there's a lot of that. So a lot of that is just sort of inside baseball stuff. But, no, I Neil, to me, I mean, for me, he jumped the shark in the 90s. I haven't really listened to anything new he's done. I mean, we're all getting older and, you know, you have a shelf life.
Yeah, yeah.
But the stuff that, you know, his great stuff, and there's so much of it, is in my DNA, really. I had done a whole series of interviews with Stephen Stills around 2000. I still have the time. It's not in the book. Well, it was part of it's in the book. Anyway, I had like 4 hours of interview.
Wow.
And he would talk a lot about how he and Neil were very, very different. That this is Stills, right? So you're
getting
salt. But he's like, I like to put these records together very painstakingly and do a million takes and do this. And well, Neil will go in and cut it once. He'll do that was the rehearsal. No, that's the master. We just did it. Very, very different. So I always put like the whole Crosby, Stills, and Nash thing over here, if you will. You can't see me, but I'm gesturing to the left, and then Neil Young on the right. I mean, they only sort of fell together initially out of, I guess, Neil needing a gig, you know, because, and I think that artists respond to that much more than what did you have for breakfast or were the 60s swinging, you know, because that's the connection. You know, not even so much the music and the songs, but how did you make this record? Petty loved to talk about making records. And so that would be the kind of questions I asked. And, you know, not the least of which that a lot of these I was writing for Goldmine, which was very heavily a record collector's magazine in those days. You'd ask, like, well, you know, you put this song on the B-side of the single, but it wasn't on the album. Why was that? You know, that there's a lot of that. So a lot of that is just sort of inside baseball stuff. But no, I Neil, to me, I mean, for me, he jumped the shark in the 90s. I haven't really listen to anything new he's done. I mean, we're all getting older and, you know, you have a shelf life. The stuff that, you know, his great stuff, and there's so much of it, is in my DNA, really.
Absolutely. Great stuff from journalist Bill DeYoung from Florida. Well, that's where he lives. He's interviewed everybody over the years. And we met because he interviewed me. So got to know him from then. And it's really good and interesting to hear his story. He's written several books as well. We'll be back in a moment with Denise Maiton telling her part two story of Moments That Rock.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant-quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
And a big hearty warm welcome to you all again. This is Moments That Rock on the Pantheon Group of Podcasts. This lady was on the show a few weeks back now, actually. Denise has got more Moments That Rock. She's been in the industry a long time, and she's a gem, so check her out.
I think probably take that. When they first were signed by BMG and by RCA, I like Nick Raymond. I work with Nick a lot, and we used to sort of play his stuff and everything. And I remember he'd signed the boys, and he sent them up to my office, because at the time I'd run the telesales department in West Brom. And anyway, these five boys come up, and they're literally boys. And they've been instructed to do a little performance, because I'd got 20 telesales girls at the time, and the boys had been instructed to do a little performance. So they put a record on and did a dance routine at the back of the office, and we all had a lovely, lovely time, and, you know, chatted and everything. And I remember them leaving my office and thinking, oh, they're lovely boys, but they're not going anywhere. And I genuinely never dreamed that they'd be at the level. And, you know, we went on with, Nick kept playing the stuff and everything. I think it was Hugh Goldsmith that turned that one round. He came in because Nick and I used to have, we used to have sit-downs in his office. And I don't know if you remember Nick Raymond, but We'd sit in his office and he'd go, Denise, I've got this band. They can sell, if they're on front cover of Smash Hits, they'll sell more copies than anyone. Everybody loves them. Nigel was managing them. I'm still good friends with Nigel. He's a lovely, lovely man. But Nigel had he'd put all his own money in. He'd mortgaged his house and everything to get this band. And they'd be on Smash Hits and they'd be on the front cover, and that had selling minutes, like, but then they put out a record and it would just go to, well, it's stumbling at 126 or something like that. And anyway,
they were doing all those best disco in towns, weren't they, back then?
Yeah,
live performances with like a dance audience.
They were doing all of that. They were doing all the gay clubs. They were literally, Nigel was working them, and Nigel got a great brain anyway. He was a fantastic manager. Funny enough, when I went into management, I thought a lot about things Nigel would say or do. But anyway, Nick said to me the one day, he said, we're selling like magazines, but not not records. And I said, well, maybe you've not made a great record. So anyway, they went away and Hugh Goldsmith came into the label and he said, look, we're not going to rush out anymore, because the inclination when something's flopping is to just keep pushing stuff out and everything. And it, what it meant is they got things like A Million Love Songs, but you didn't break a boy band on a ballad. And they got good songs, but not anything to be the next single. And anyway, and then they ended up doing the Only Takes a Minute. And that was when it just went out of the water. It just went absolutely balmy. And then the rest, it was like we got, by this point as well, because I was doing the National Accounts, I was doing Entertainment UK, and that my buyer, who I'd got a brilliant relationship with, by the time he came to Only Takes a Minute, he said, look, I've given you Woolworths Records of the Week. I've given you this on every single. This is the last one. He said, I'm not saying it's the last one we'll take, but it's the last one you'll get Record of the Week. And anyway, and then the track, I think, went to number 8 or something. But it ended up establishing them. And it went mad after that.
It's interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, but they didn't break America, where if you look at the equivalent with NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, they were global. But I think Take That did really well in Europe, but they didn't break here, did they?
Gary Barlow's an amazing songwriter, but I think he writes in a very British kind of way.
Yeah, good point.
Back for Good was a genuine total crossover record. You just knew. I remember Nick sent me Back for Good. I was living in the Midlands. I was travelling to London but living in the Midlands. And Nick sent me Back for Good on a cassette tape by courier. He said, Denise, I really want your opinion on it. And anyway, and I was driving to my mother-in-law's. It was a Saturday morning, and I was driving to my mother-in-law's, and I played it 3 times, which I got on the journey. I got to my mum-in-law's and phoned him immediately. I said, Nick, this is the biggest record they've ever had, easily. And he's going, you're kidding. I said, no, it's the biggest record ever. And I just knew it. And that was the only one that took a shot in America. It was some.
It's funny hearing you say all this, Denise, because the thing is, from what you've been saying, is like you've moved into management. But in a way, A&R would have been a good step up because you had an ability to spot talent. Even if it wasn't a record for your record collection, you could see there was a market for it because you'd worked in sales, but you chose management.
Yeah, I think.
And you need a bit of A&R skills to manage.
To tell you the truth, I think the reason at BMG and since to a degree is why I think I've got punter's ears. I think some people can listen. I couldn't listen to a record like an A&R person does and say, oh, it needs to come up a few levels here and it needs this and it needs that. I just look and go, that's a great song.
Being on the other side and taking it to radio, you need to know that it's going to connect from one play. It can't be like, oh, once you've heard it 3 or 4 times, you're like, that doesn't happen. So it has to have that instant appeal. And that's what makes a commercial hit, which potentially can be a massive international hit, because England's not the biggest record market, but it's incredibly influential. Get a hit in the UK, you're guaranteed a release in the States and Europe.
Oh, gosh, absolutely. I tend to find the car a very good barometer. Most people, they listen to music on the radio in the car or now on Bluetooth connections or whatever. But back then, you either listened on the radio or on a CD. And I know that I've had times when before we just got the hookup that you can just hook your phone to the car. I've had times when I've had a track come over to me at midnight on an email. I've burnt off a CD and I've been in my PJs and got and driven round the block before I'll pass an opinion on it.
I've got a great little story for you. I interviewed Dave Robinson, who was obviously Stiff Records and then Ireland in the 80s for Unforgettable Fire Time and the rest is history. But he put together the Marley compilation. But when I interviewed Dave Robinson about Legend, the compilation, and he said he was driving around in his car and his wife was pregnant and he was putting together the track list in the order. And every time the baby, like in utero, was rumbling around in his wife's belly, he'd move the track up to like, oh, that's track 1, side 1.
if you think about it, we were, I think it was back in the 80s, we were at a board meeting, and the chairman at the time, who I think was John Berkheimer, American guy, and he went up, someone had got their track that they were playing us all for feedback, and he went up and he turned it down, and he said, every track sounds huge on a great big system, every track sounds good. Let's listen to it, how your average punter will listen to it, and then decide if it's good. And it is a thing, you know, because some records sound astonishing on speakers, work on the radio, or they don't work. So I suppose from what you did and from what I did, we had to listen to how it would sound in the capacity that we wanted to, like in my case, the public to hear it.
Excellent. You've been listening to Denise Maton on Moments That Rock. She had a great career in finding people like Simon Cowell. What an A&R job that was, eh? And starting it all off tonight on Moments That Rock was Mr. Bill DeYoung with part two of his interview from a few months back, where he's talking about, well, all the people he's interviewed. Hope you enjoyed the show. We come out weekly. I upload them on a Monday. If I fail, they're on a Tuesday, but I'll do my best to put them out every Monday. Plenty of news to come from Pantheon in weeks to come. But meanwhile, thank you for listening. Subscribe, review, and tell all your friends. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.